Well, one of the enemy's main tools for undermining confidence in God's Word, especially among young people in our schools, is science. Science. We are told that settled science contradicts a literal reading of the Bible. And so unless we want to look like idiots, we must go with science. We can have our faith if we want it. Why would we want it? But we can have it. But it must yield to the experts when we are dealing with matters of the creation of the universe, or the origins of the universe, shall we say. We don't really want to talk about the creation of the universe. Or really any matter that involves the material world. It's not my purpose tonight to give any kind of a deep treatment of this ongoing battle, and I'm no expert on the subject anyway. One does wonder, though, how believers have managed to be in the forefront of so many important scientific discoveries over the centuries if they are so ignorant. And the idea that there exists now a noble breed of scientists who have no agenda, who are only going wherever the evidence leads in these matters, is pure bunk. Everyone is interpreting data according to his worldview. And we don't apologize for that or pretend it isn't true. Others do pretend that it isn't true. Moreover, science is always changing, is it not? For instance, genetics is challenging much of the received wisdom about evolutionary theory. What was thought to be settled science becomes unsettled. Beware of building your house on that shifting sand. I bring all of this up because tonight's passage does speak to the world that God created. And what Job knew about it from observation and inspiration. What is remarkable is that we see here understandings that only became accepted among the great thinkers relatively recently in human history. But it seemed to be common knowledge to believers 4,000 years ago. Interesting. The point is that we should be confident that when God does speak to the creation of the world in his written revelation, he does so accurately. Job served the same powerful, orderly, majestic, mysterious God that we do. And his knowledge of what God does with his creation led him to be more cautious than his friends about declaring authoritatively what God was doing in human circumstances. Okay? He's making a connection. God's mysterious in what he does with this world that he's made. Doesn't it make sense that we would find that what he does in our circumstances is often mysterious, not able to be easily figured out? A God whose dealings with his creation is beyond our grasp would naturally challenge our assumptions in other areas. We've jumped right over three chapters. Did you pull a muscle while we did that? We jumped right over three chapters to land in 25 and 26 this evening. We will pick up some of chapter 22 next time. Chapters 23 and 24 we will not look at. You're free to do so, though. It's a free country. You can read through those two chapters. They give us more of Job's contention that evil is not quickly or obviously judged. He gives a number of specific examples involving thieves and abusers, murderers and adulterers who seem to pay no earthly price for their wicked ways. And he concludes all of that giving of evidence by challenging his friends to contradict his presentation of reality. He's saying, this is what's going on, guys. What do you have to say about it? So we begin in the text tonight with Bildad's response to Job's words. His response to Job kind of throwing that down and saying, okay, what do you have to say about this? And this chapter, as you can see, six verses, gives us Bildad's view of God's creation. Let's read that. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered, "Dominion and awe belong to him who establishes peace in his heights. Is there any number to his troops? And upon whom does his light not rise? How then can a man be just with God? Or how can he be clean who is born of woman? If even the moon has no brightness and the stars are not pure in his sight, how much less man, that maggot, and the son of man, that worm?" We note two main aspects of this reaction to Job's words, just right away. First, Bildad does not take up the challenge of Job. In some ways, you read his response almost as a non sequitur. It's like, well, you didn't really deal with, I mean, Job went on at some length saying, and there's this, and there's this, and there's this, and there's this, and this is all happening. And, okay, no real addressing of that. All that Bildad seems to have heard is that Job is taking God to task for, a lack of justice in everyday life. He kind of gets that general theme and just begins to respond to it again out of his own prejudices. He doesn't admit to any problems with his own opinions regarding sowing and reaping. It's like he didn't even hear all of those counter examples from Job. He simply indicates that Job should not be talking like this about what was taking place all around him. You're just on the wrong track. This third offering from Bildad, this third time he's spoken, it's blessedly short, right? Things get shorter and shorter, and we're happy just to only get six verses of this. And I think it's because he doesn't have really anything to add to what has gone before. And in fact, Zophar, the youngest guy of the three, he will not even make a third speech. This one-trick pony that these guys have been riding for so long has finally collapsed from overuse. There's nothing more there to say. So they just kind of peter out. The second aspect of these verses is that, like so much that Job's counselors have had to say, there is nothing wrong with these statements themselves. If we just opened up the Bible, read Job 25, right on, brother. This Bildad knows what he's talking about. Good guy. Wouldn't mind having him as a friend, as a counselor. He knows what's going on. There's some debate about what Bildad was getting at in the last verse. But this is all material that is echoed elsewhere in Scripture. Bildad has a respect for the God who could make the universe and control it. I mean, he's one of us in that, in a very important sense. But in the context of what Job was going through, again, this content is not helpful. This is still the one-sided argument that you should just not be asking questions like the ones you're bringing up, Job. You just shouldn't even been doing this. There is no recognition of the complexity of discerning God's plan in the events that they all witnessed every day. It's just amazing that they will not allow themselves to actually deal with what does go on every day. There's never any kind of head scratching and, wow, you've got a point, and what really is going on there? It's always right back to an offense against Job. What do we have here specifically? Well, God's pictured in the heaven that he established. He made the world, so he has the right to rule it. He's the only being that is truly awesome. God made a multitude of angels. God makes the sun to shine upon all his creatures. At one time, there was a saying that the sun never set on the British Empire. But it certainly has never set on God's dominion. It's all his sun shining down on his earth. And then we have this emphasis on man's sin. They've certainly been right there as far as the man's sinfulness. He's sinful from conception. He cannot be just or clean before God. If the heavenly bodies cannot compete with God's holy brightness, how can man presume to stand before him? Every light is simply a reflected one with its source in God. All statements that we would agree with. In fact, proclaim. Verse 6 is a very blunt statement. It's perhaps not the most tactful one, given that Job probably was dealing with maggots and worms in his physical condition at this very time. Some think that this was over the top in its declaration of man's inferiority to God. But we do have Christ's words in Psalm 22 about being a worm and not a man. God calls Israel a worm in Isaiah 41:14. That kind of language is out there. So I don't have a problem with seeing sinful man this way in contrast to God. Man in his sinful state. But again, we note the lack of any mercy here. We don't mind hearing the bad news that, yeah, man is a maggot, a worm, or whatever, as long as we hear the good news too about what God does for us to lift us up from that hopeless state. I think maybe the biggest problem here is that, again, that's coming out of how he's seeing Job. And Job was not trying to be a rival to God. Job was trying to understand God. And God himself had called Job righteous, the most righteous man on the earth, not a maggot. So again, while there is truth in a certain context to even verse 6, this is not good here. God had transformed Job by his grace into someone who lived righteously, whom God was pleased with. Well, this last overall statement, chapter 25, by these three men who came to Job, we're going to get a few words from Eliphaz next time, because that's going to connect to stuff that goes on past 26. We're kind of, you know, connecting things as we get to a given message. But here we are at the end of what they had to say, and it gives us an opportunity to pause for a moment and review, you know, what they've been saying, what they've accomplished. How do we kind of summarize this. And really, I think we have to say, since they started talking, it's all been pretty much on the failure side of the ledger. Not that it hasn't been true, but in the context of this given situation, it's been a failure. I thought that John Walvoord had a good list that summarized their speeches. Just kind of went, you know, give me some bullet points on how to remember, you know, what they've been saying, what they've been doing. And it's pretty much in the form of what they have not done. Here, I'll just give it to you. They did not express any sympathy. Okay? And that's remarkable. Through this whole thing, they never one time said, you know, they never verbalized, okay, there was seemingly some of that when they didn't speak, but when they verbalized, there was never any sympathy for his situation. They did not pray for Job that we read of. Okay, maybe they did, but we don't read of it. They basically ignore Job's expressions of agony. Okay, that's part of the sympathy thing, I guess. They were more intent on schooling Job than figuring out his real problem. Definitely had their own agenda to impress upon him. They were defensive and argumentative. They belittled rather than encouraged. They assumed that they knew why Job was struggling and had no interest in any facts that contradicted their view. So often they did not actually respond to what Job was saying, what his questions were, what his struggle was. Therefore, their solution did not fit the problem. So again, I think we should take note of these things for our own counseling. Let's move on to our second point, and it's a brief look at Job's view of Bildad's words. Chapter 26, verses 1 through 4. Then Job responded, "What a help you are to the weak. How you have saved the arm without strength. What counsel you have given to one without wisdom. What helpful insight you have abundantly provided. To whom have you uttered words? And whose spirit was expressed through you?" This is the beginning of Job's last and longest presentation. And I believe that I detect a mocking tone here. Verses 2 and 3 make it clear that Job was not at all helped by what Bildad had to say. Job is in a weak position here. He's got nothing earthly to rely on. He is struggling. He's hurting. He needs strengthening from a sympathetic listener. But rather than raising Job's arm, as Job refers to here, Bildad was pushing it down. Maybe giving it a little twist. For good measure. Does it hurt when I do this, Job? These three insist on combining truths that Job already accepts, okay? On the one hand, they keep spouting these things that Job would never contest, but they combine that with explanations of Job's suffering that do not fit the circumstances. Oh, this just must have come across as unbearably condescending. It's been just so hard to listen to this. Always off on the wrong tangent as these diatribes droned on. Here Bildad speaks of the mighty creating God. Wonderful. But the intent is to put Job in his place. through talking about that. It's not really about praising God. It's about, Job, you need to submit to what we're saying. Job's saying, I'm already in my place. I've been put in my place very thoroughly by God. The question is, why am I in this place? And you're not giving me one bit of wisdom that helps me with that question. Why am I in this place? Because none of what you have said applies to me. Verse 4 is a little tricky to interpret. I get the impression from the first question that Job is asking Bildad to whom he was speaking. You know, maybe he's looking behind himself and saying, you know, essentially, are you talking to me here? Really? Surely you can't be addressing these words to me. You must be talking to some clueless person, you know, who's gathered here around us somewhere. I can't believe that this is what you have to say to me. That second question is more barbed. And whose spirit was expressed through you? That's a good one. It takes me back somewhat to chapter 4, verse 15, when Eliphaz was babbling about the spirit that visited him in the night, you know, and you're not exactly sure what all that was about, just that it wasn't helpful. Whatever he thought he had received, you know, it wasn't a helpful thing for Job, and there seemed to be some doubt just what kind of a spirit that was. Just what spirit was behind Bildad's words? It did not seem to be God's. Even though he was saying true things. And again, we're reminded that Satan is lurking about in the background here. That's really what made me think about this. It's interesting because when we really saw Satan, when he was blatant and obvious, he wasn't getting any traction as far as what he was really trying to accomplish. Now he is getting somewhere. He's having more of an impact than when he was very obviously at work. We're not seeing him specifically, but we're seeing his handiwork in the discouragement that's going on. And when you look at chapter 25, I think that this question, and whose spirit was expressed through you, that question becomes very sobering when you think of the content of those verses. Bildad had not said anything technically wrong, but it was still what the enemy wanted him to say in this context. You know, that really makes you think and realize we're up against a clever foe, and only by God's grace are we going to give good counsel. Well, let's get to the meat of this message now as we come to Job's view of God's creation in verses 5 through 14. And as has happened so many times before, Job one-ups the person trying to teach him about God and his ways. We've seen this before in Job. That a person will say, oh, well, you know, don't you understand that God is like this? Do I understand that God is like this? Let me enlighten you. He will see Bildad, his creating God, and raise the stakes tenfold. While Bildad's view lent itself to a God easily figured out, Job's God expands our perspective well beyond what we can comprehend. We'll begin with Job's presentation in verses 5 and 6. The departed spirits tremble under the waters and their inhabitants. Naked is Sheol before him, and Abaddon has no covering. Well, this is a seemingly odd place to start when declaring the wonders of our creating God. But it's interesting. It was asked the other day, might have been Rose, in one of our discussions, when God created hell. When did God create hell? Was that part of his original, you know, creative work? And we were saying, well, yes, essentially. I don't know that this passage definitively answers that question. It was not in my mind when that question came up. But here, the abode of departed spirits seems to be treated in the same way as everything else that God has made, and, you know, kind of connected to it. But the first scene that Job draws our attention to is the departed spirits trembling under the earth. That word trembling, it involves anguish, torment. They're not having a good time. These spirits are under the waters and all the creatures that live in the sea, essentially. Hell is always presented as located under the surface of the earth. God's word always presents it that way. And we even see some striking situations, for instance, in the wilderness, where the ground opens up and it says they go down alive to Sheol. That's where it is located. But these shades, which is the literal meaning of these departed spirits, these shades, they seem to be visible to the living God. Perhaps visible to the whole spiritual world that we can't see. It's going to be one of the interesting things, you know, when this body, immortal body, gives out and we are part of the spiritual world, right? I mean, isn't that one of the things? You just, what does that world look like and what do you see? The word for spirits in Hebrew is not the normal one. It's an uncommon word. It speaks to those who are the elite among men. He's looking at a specific kind of departed spirit. We almost have the flavor here of that bizarre race of men who existed before the flood. There might be some connection here. Those, you know, created when the sons of God came to the daughters of men and so forth, Genesis 6. And that would fit well, I think, with the idea of he seeing them under the water, you know, the flood took them away is what caused them to depart, and he's seeing them under all of that. Whatever the case, God is able to send those who oppose him to punishment in Sheol, or Abaddon we have here. Sheol we've had previously in the book of Job, but this is the first mention of Abaddon. And commentators pretty much across the board that I encountered equated the two, Sheol, Abaddon. But the word Abaddon gives a much stronger sense of the destruction that awaits the rebellious soul. This certainly would indicate more the area of Sheol that would involve the departed spirits of evil men, because it's a place of destruction. All six references to Abaddon in the Old Testament are in the wisdom literature. Again, kind of interesting. In the only instance in the New Testament, a being who arises from the abyss in Revelation is named Abaddon. Maybe that fits into my little theory here. It's just a theory. Perhaps he is the leader of those powerful evil angels who corrupted men before the flood. We know that they were committed to chains. They were imprisoned. And perhaps that is when he is being released to do his evil before the final judgment. What we're seeing is that God controls the place that he created for the punishment of the wicked. Next, Job moves to what is above the earth. We've seen what's beneath. Let's move to what's above. We had some content on this subject in chapter 9, verses 6 through 9, if you remember, where we saw Job's familiarity with the constellations. This takes us a step further in astronomical knowledge. Verses 7 through 10. He stretches out the north over empty space and hangs the earth on nothing. He wraps up the waters in his clouds, and the cloud does not burst under them. He obscures the face of the full moon and spreads his cloud over it. He has inscribed a circle on the surface of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. The word stretching is commonly used of God's creation of the heavens. You'll find that in the Psalms and other places, stretching it out. Just a picture of his creative work in the heavens. The word north is used because that's at the top of a map, okay? And we, you know, are speaking of what's seen as being above the earth, you know. That's, in a sense, north, if we're looking, you know, vertically that way, up into the heavens. That's the north. But Job makes it clear that the earth is actually surrounded by the heavens. The earth is hanging on nothing. It is suspended in empty space. This is quite a remarkable statement, this conception. This statement assumes an ex nihilo creation. God had to make the heavens and the earth out of nothing before positioning them as we now see them. Because it's clear, this God is positioning the earth in his universe that he has made. But to see the earth as unsupported in space, that was not in accord with any of the mythologies of man, the thinking of man. They considered the earth to be resting, you know, on the back of a turtle or held up by Atlas. You know, some such nonsense. Job knew the truth about God's creation. He knew that the world was suspended in empty space. Then Job shows us that he understands that clouds are made of water vapor. This wrapping up is easily seen as poetic language for evaporation. He's talking about the evaporation cycle, that it involves the clouds. The cloud, even though it's got all that water in it, it does not burst, despite the great weight that would be involved. It floats along in the sky until it releases its burden back to the earth. Verse 9 could be a further mention of what clouds do. They do cover the face of the moon at times, but it also might be the clouds of glory that obscure the throne of God from our eyes. The word translated full moon is literally throne, so this could be a reference to God's heaven and that we cannot see it, that he's obscured that from our eyes. Verse 10 is perhaps the biggest eye-opener in our whole passage. All commentators agree that here we have the description of the earth as round, saying we have a round earth 4,000 years ago. Thousands of years passed before men were certainly able to prove it and definitely believe that that's the way the earth was. Here, Job is saying that the horizon is curved. You have a round earth and a curved horizon. That is most easily observed on the water. He talks about it being on the water. That's when you can most easily see that. There are some different thoughts on the boundary of light and darkness and what he's getting at there. I'm not going to present all of that. I don't presume to have the last word. I'm going to tell you what it made me think of, okay, when I read that. What I see is the line between light and dark as the earth rotates on its axis. Okay? It's around, and it's not only round, but it's rotating so that there's always a boundary that goes around the earth where, you know, it's light on one side and dark on the other. I once saw the most fascinating map in a game store over at the Galleria Mall in St. Louis. And I mean, it was really expensive, but if I had ever been, you know, if I'd have had money, man, I would have bought this thing and I would have just stared at it and wasted a whole bunch of time, with it. So it's good that I didn't have any money. But this map showed that line where the sun was coming up on the earth. Okay. And so you saw it moving. And so right then you could tell this is where the sun is coming up, you know, Papua New Guinea or wherever it happened to be. On the other side, it was of course dark, but over here it was light, and you could see where it was turning from night to day and from day to night. I just was utterly fascinated by this, and it just made me just think of, you know, the greatness of God and how he positioned the earth in relationship to the sun and all of that. Perhaps that is what Job is describing here. You know, if so, how amazing is that, that he's saying, you know, because of the curvature and the way the sun is, there's this boundary of light and darkness that you have set in. Well, verses 11 through 13 brings things a little closer to home. The pillars of heaven tremble and are amazed at his rebuke. He quieted the sea with his power, and by his understanding he shattered Rahab. By his breath the heavens are cleared. His hand has pierced the fleeing serpent. So this gets more into stuff that we're dealing with on the earthly scene. Commonly we have mountains trembling here, whether this is volcanic activity, earthquake, whatever. God clearly brings these convulsions by his own command. Earthquakes happen by his command of his creation. He quiets the sea with his power. It's hard not to think of Jesus on the Sea of Galilee when you read that. You know, peace be still. You know, it's done. Okay. He orders that. Also think of Jonah, you know. Bring up a storm if you need to. So God hurled a storm at that, like a javelin at that ship that Jonah was on, you know, and then he made it calm again. We have the controlling of Rahab again here. Remember that from back in chapter 9, 9:13? Talked about Rahab. It's a term for the forces that desire chaos. Really a picture in many ways, I think, of demonic activity. God has the upper hand in all attempts to disrupt his creation. By his spirit, he also clears away the storms that frighten us. That's verse 13. The serpent. Always interesting. Well, you know, whenever you see the serpent, whoa, you know, what are we talking about here? That could be the line of clouds that's moving away like a snake, kind of. He, you know, sees it moving off and that kind of away in the sky. Others see this as a constellation that's shaped like a serpent. Whatever's being pictured here in the observable realm, it does seem to speak to God's overturning of the attempts of Satan and his minions to thwart his plans for his world. He's in control is the idea of his creation. Would you not agree that Job has blown away Bildad's effort to convey the power of God in creation? I mean, you know, we went from the junior varsity to the varsity, you know, pretty quickly here, I think, in these two chapters. And Job has shown an amazing knowledge of specifics. And yet there's mystery here. What is God doing with this Sheol that he sees so clearly? Why do the mountains tremble just like the inhabitants of Abaddon? Same word there. Why does God obscure the heavens? What's really going on with this cosmic tension that Job presents to us? And he is presenting to us a creation that though it's of God and he controls it, there are issues. It's not the perfect creation right now. What's going on? Lots of questions here. Where does man fit into this battle that is clearly raging here? Boy, if Job only knew. If Job only knew how he was fitting in to the battle. He was right in the thick of it. In verse 14, Job comes to his point in all of this. Behold, these are the fringes of his ways. As mind-blowing as what I've said is right here, we're on the fringes. We're on the periphery. How faint a word we hear of him. But his mighty thunder, who can understand? Job had barely scratched the surface in relating the ways of God with his creation. Do you not wonder what else Job knew that he did not relate here? I think he knew many other things about God's creation, things that were not accepted, received, well known, whatever. Even as we come toward the modern age. Be interesting to know. And these things were accepted, these things that he had to say. No one corrects his presentation. It was like, wow, yeah, Job, you're right. Whether it was new to them or not, they accepted it. But whatever else he did know, he's saying, it's all just a faint echo of what there is to know about God. And I think that remains the case, and I think it will always remain the case. We will grow in our knowledge of God. Strongly believe that, and you've heard me say, I think it continues on beyond death, on through eternity, growth, understanding, develop our wisdom. But we're never going to fathom it all. And that's a good thing. I mean, we are the creatures. And I think that last question really says it all. His mighty thunder, who can understand? We can analyze lightning and thunder today, and they do. We can pretend that, it's just this physical process that no relation to a creating God. No, don't look at that. We're just understanding just these natural processes, and we're getting ever better at predicting this, that, and the other thing about the weather. I mean, you can try to explain it all you want, but when it thunders, we tremble. We know God is expressing his awesome might. We know we don't really understand. We know that he's telling us that we had better humble ourselves and know that he is God. If these three counselors thought that they could reduce the God of chapter 26 to a few easily grasped principles, they were greatly mistaken. The Christian thinker Augustine, who lived long ago. Do you like Augustine better than Augustine? Hear it both ways. Well, anyway, that guy lived long ago, by the way. 400, somewhere in there. He tried once to fully comprehend the Trinity. He tried to comprehend a lot of things. definitely had a brain and thought of many good things with it. Gonna fully comprehend the Trinity. He was walking along the shore at the time, and he came upon a boy who was capturing seawater in a seashell and then taking it up onto the land and pouring it into a little hole in the sand. And Augustine asked the child what he was doing. And he responded, "I'm trying to put the ocean in my hole." And Augustine immediately realized that that was what he was trying to do. The more we learn about God, the more we discover how little we really do know about Him. So what do we do? Do we not fully investigate what He has revealed about Himself? No, that's not what we're saying. We seek to understand all that God has revealed because He went to a good bit of trouble to get us this information. So we do have a responsibility to learn it as best we can. And then when we've done that and done that and done that and come to our best understandings of what God is telling us about Himself, then we fall down in utter amazement before the infinite God. And we confess our lack of comprehension. We submit to the truth that His thoughts are not our thoughts, and His ways are not our ways. Let's pray. Lord, when we think of the wisdom and the might that lie behind the universe that we see surrounding us, we respond like David, "Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it." But then again, You are the one who establishes a relationship with us. You are the one who came and died for us. You've loved us and befriended us. May all that we can grasp and all that we cannot grasp lead us to praise You now and forever. Amen.